So as you know, we've been talking about making this journey toward the promised land with the Israelites. And the reason we've been doing this is the fact that the Israelites, the Israelites reflect the human condition. They do the same things that we do. They grumble and we grumble. They complain and we complain. We mess things up. They obviously have messed things up. And to move beyond that kind of way of life means to engage in something called spiritual growth. And when we left the story off last week, Moses had said, are you all ready to grow in your faith? And everybody in Israel said, we're ready. And Moses went up the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments, to move the people from being passive followers to embark on something what we'd call discipleship. And when they did that, it was short-lived. Matter of fact, they couldn't even wait to receive the Ten Commandments before abandoning this whole idea of spiritual growth. Moses had gone up on the mountain, and when he was up there for so long, they thought he wasn't coming back. They thought that maybe he died or he abandoned them, and so they said, well, we can't wait for this spiritual growth to happen from Moses, so they rebelled, and what they ended up doing was they ended up building a golden calf. They said, Moses, we're tired of you being this intermediary between God and us. We don't need you. We need a golden calf. So they made this thing, and it wasn't a different... Now, what's interesting about this is it wasn't a different God. They called this golden calf that they created the Lord of Israel. They didn't. It wasn't a new God. It was like, this is going to be our God. This is the God of Israel. This is the one who led us out of Egypt. We don't have a need for an invisible God or Moses to be this in-between. And so they built this while Moses was up on the mountain, and when they got back, needless to say, Moses wasn't all that happy, right? Moses comes down, and he sees this, and it's like the parent who says to their kids, their teenagers, okay, we as adults are going away from the week. We're going to trust you to watch over the house while we're gone. And we have one rule while you're gone. What's the one rule? No parties. Parents come home, they had a party. That's what's going on here. Not only was Moses not happy, but God wasn't happy either. Matter of fact, God said there's going to be consequences for those who don't repent, you know, change their attitude. No surprise there. Because in real life, there's always consequences for the decisions we make, either good, bad, or unintended. Matter of fact, God is so upset at this, it's almost like a parent. God tells Moses, look, after all this, it's time for all of you to head to the promised land, this thing we've been talking about. But here's the thing, I'm not going to go with. God's so upset, he's like, I'm sending you, and I'm not going to go. I still love you. I'm going to have an angel lead you, but I'm not going. I'm a little right here with you all. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, same thing. You're a parent. You're really mad at your kid. You love them, and you're like, look, for the good of everybody, you need to make yourself scarce. You know, I can't see your face right now. I'm really upset. I love you, but go to your room. Just, we can't talk right now. We just got to have some space. Maybe that only happened in my house, but that was kind of what's going on. And so Moses is like, well, that's not going to work. We really need you. Not just an angel. We really need you. And so Moses begs God to say, please don't send an angel. You need to lead us. And God relents, and God says, okay, but I'm only doing it for you, not everybody else. Not for the people. I'm doing it for you, Moses, because I like you. So that's what happens. The rest of the book of Exodus, I just wanted to give you a fill-in on here. So the rest of the book of Exodus is really God talking to Moses and giving instruction on how to set up the worship of Israel. And in other words, all the different pieces of equipment that God says, this, if you're going to worship me, here's all these things. And so God gives all this instruction. It continues on through the book of Leviticus with ceremonial law, and the story itself doesn't actually pick up again, roughly speaking, until the book of Numbers. And so if we were going to look at the book of Numbers, and it's called that because they do two census during that time, and that's why it's called Numbers, because they're counting the people. The story really resumes at about chapter 10 of Numbers. I mean, give or take. And it begins this way. On the 20th day of the second month of the second year, the cloud, that is the presence of God, lifted from above the tabernacle of the testimony, in other words, the worship area of God, and the Israelites set out from the desert of Sinai. And you can see there in that picture of since the end of Exodus, God had given instruction of not only how the worship area of God was going to be, which is in the center, it's hard to see, but also how all the tribes would arrange themselves as they traveled. So that's kind of what it looked like when God said, you're going to organize yourself in this way. So all these things had happened, and God says, okay, it's time to go. And now we learn that they've been on this journey for 2 years, 1 month, and 20 days since they left Egypt. They've been residing in Midian, where this mountain of God is, where Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb is. And he says, now it's time to leave. You've been there about 11 months, about a year, and now it's time to head to the promised land. So they travel north. But here's the problem with that. As soon as they start heading north, the same problems that they had before when they were traveling begin again. They first complain about the food. Then, of all things, Miriam and Aaron, who are Moses' brother and sister, essentially tried to stage a coup on Moses. Now, God wouldn't put up with that. He fixed that whole thing right up. But the same things happen again, that when they're traveling, there seems to be some problems. So they get to the edge of the promised land, and God does the thing that he said he'd do. He's like, I'm going to get you there. And you can see by the map, which is really exciting, that God takes them all the way here to Bethel. So I think that's kind of exciting. But Moses thinks about this big decision. And he says, if we have this promise, what we need to do is we need to understand what we're getting ourselves into, which is a reasonable thing. Send in the spies, find out everything you can so that we will make an informed decision versus an emotional decision. Which, by the way, healthy living here, good sense living, is that whenever we need to make a major decision, it's good to gather information and not make a gut decision, but make an informed decision. So Moses is doing that smart, well thought out, so we can make a plan. So the spies go. And then the spies return. And what happens is when they come back to report, it is a good news, bad news scenario. So first the good news, they say, we went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here's the fruit. And on this pole are things like grapes and pomegranates and figs, proof that it is this great place to live. Now throughout the Old Testament, we keep hearing that this land is flowing with milk and honey, which is an allusion to abundance, and it's really turned this way, that if the land cannot support cattle, cattle won't produce milk. So milk is a luxury, and it's a good enough land that the cows would be able to produce milk, and honey can only be produced if there's an abundance of plants in which to pollinate and have nectar. So milk and honey is above the kind of the basic necessities, that things are really good when you have those things going for you. Now, we might not use those terms. You might say, this place is so good, it is a land flowing with pizza and pop, right? I'm from the Midwest, I say pop, I don't say soda, so a land flowing with... Some of us might say, this is a land of prime rib and baked potatoes, right? And I know some of you would say, this is a land of flowing with sushi and wasabi, right? You know, to each their own, but you get the picture here, is this is really a great place. So that's the good news, so let's move on to the bad news. So it says, but the people who live there are powerful. Their cities are fortified, they got walls and they're large. We saw descendants of Anak, giants, by the way, that's what their definition would be. And the Amalekites, we've already dealt with the Amalekites once. They live in the Negev, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, even the Canaanites. They're everywhere. Lots of people, including giants. So now this decision, to occupy the promised land just got more difficult. However, here's the thing you should know, is that none of this is a surprise to God. This isn't a surprise at all. Matter of fact, not only is God omnipresent, he can also see everything too. Think about that. God knew what was coming. Matter of fact, if we take the story all the way back to Exodus chapter 3, when Moses is with God at the burning bush, at the very beginning of the story, what do we hear? "So I have come down to rescue the Israelites from the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them out of that land into a good and spacious land, one, a land flowing with milk and honey, and the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites." Say that fast 10 times. By the way, Sam, you did a nice job getting all those names right. Thank you. So this isn't a surprise to God. God didn't go, "Oh, I didn't expect that. Oh, this wasn't a part of the plan." God's like, "Yeah, this is how it's going to work. This isn't a hitch. This isn't a pothole." God's like, "This is how it goes." But God leaves the decision to the Israelites to make. And that's the thing. And the same is true for us, is that when we make decisions in our life, God will leave us to make the decision for good or for ill. Nothing's changed since the beginning of human history. God allows us to choose our future. And so it's decision time for the Israelites. Do they retreat in fear, or do they move forward in faith? I mean, fear can keep us up all night long, but faith makes one fine pillow. So that's what happens. Do they go their own way, or do they follow God's leading? I mean, what a night that was after this report, right? The naysayers go behind Moses' back, and they get the nation of Israel all riled up that they can't do this, that they need to turn around, that they need to go back and become slaves again. And so what these naysayers do is sow fear throughout the encampment. Okay, so hold that image for a moment. This image of fear over faith. The easier path over the harder path. And let me bring Jesus into this story a little bit. Jesus, once again, speaks to us quite clearly from the New Testament. And he tells this parable about a man who has a banquet. And this banquet he sets up, and he has all of his friends he invites, and they all RSVP with a yes. But when the time for the banquet comes, all of his friends back out, and it says this: but they all alike began to make excuses. I mean, you heard it earlier. "I just bought a house, I can't go. You know, I just bought a new car, I can't go. I'm on my honeymoon, I can't go." I mean, the Middle Eastern, you know, equivalent of that, but that's what they were saying. More important things than this party. So the guy who was throwing the banquet made alternative plans. He brought other people, vulnerable people. People whose schedule was wide open. People who don't normally get invited to anything were welcome to this party. Matter of fact, the host of the party makes a pronouncement about the original guest list. He says, "I tell you, not one of these people who were invited will get a taste of my banquet." So let's move on to the next slide. The same thing is going on with Israel. They have an opportunity to lay hold to a 500-year-old invitation to take the land, something God will help them accomplish. It will be hard, but not impossible. You know what happens? They do the same thing that the people in the parable do. They make excuses and rationalizations. Numbers chapter 13, "We can't attack those people. They're stronger than us." Once again, in Numbers 13, "We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them." Numbers 14, "Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword?" See, we're going to die. "Our wives and our children will be plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt," subtext, "to be slaves?" Just like the people invited to the banquet, excuses, rationalizations. And honestly, it's the same thing that we do. When confronted with a decision of great importance, do we even bring God into the equation? Do we make excuses of why that would not be the best path for us for any number of reasons? And sometimes it's not a decision at all. Sometimes it is just about priorities or what's the most important thing. I can't tell you how many times I've had people kind of phrase the question, you know, what are the top three priorities in your life? And the typical Christian will say, well, Christ, family, job, and, you know, so on. But the reality of it is, for a lot of Christians, Christ is not number one, two, or three at all. And you can see that in how they react to a situation, to something that upsets them. Matter of fact, if Christ was first in their lives, the thing that they're upset about wouldn't be a choice or a dilemma or even a problem. Secondly, how they respond to that isn't gracious or kind at all. It's not very Christian, complaining, talking behind people's backs, that sort of thing, and they feel justified doing it. See, priorities, set your priorities right, because if you chase two rabbits, you will lose both of them. Isn't that interesting? Or how about this one? You say your priorities aren't what you say they are. They're actually revealed in how you live. So that's what the people of Israel are doing that evening. They're sowing seeds of discontent. They're going behind the back of Moses and saying, we can't do this. And the same with the parable. The man throwing the banquet is left with an empty house because all of his guests didn't see it as a priority. And let's not mistake that this is also a metaphor for Christ and the church in this banquet. Matter of fact, the Bible uses a word to describe this. It's an interesting word. It's actually kind of a double word. It's a compound word. The word is double-minded. It shows up three times in Scripture, one in Psalm 119, the longest psalm in the Bible, and twice in the book of James. It's not a flattering word, as you can imagine. It means just what it sounds like. It means you have more than one priority in your life. So when one is double-minded, God isn't at the top of the list. Remember what Jesus said, one cannot serve two masters. And once again, to even be more specific, when Jesus is telling this parable, he's talking about himself, and he's addressing self-absorbed people who claim to put God first in their lives, but really don't. So these two stories, which are years apart, reveal human behavior and even God's response. So the majority of the Israelites, they're complaining and they refuse to enter the promised land, and God says, that's fine, I'll give it to somebody else. That's the answer. I'm going to give it to your descendants long after you are gone, so go back out to the desert, and they go out and do laps in the desert for another 40 years. And what we will discover is that life isn't any easier in the desert than it was laying a hold of the invitation that was made. Likewise, Jesus tells us that the man invites other people to the party. So we're given the power to choose in this life. And although God does not change, God's the same yesterday, today, and forever, remember there's still consequences for the decisions we make. So we can learn. We can learn from the parables of Jesus. We can learn from Israel's history. And let us not spend our lives in a spiritual desert of our own creation, where we come in to the oasis once a week and then go back out and live in the desert again. Let us not make excuses for why we cannot respond to Jesus' invitation to grow closer to him. And for some of us, it may even mean some time of self-reflection and self-evaluation of priorities. See, the goodness of God tells us this, that we can return to him at any time, and that God will respond to that change of heart at any time. So let us not spend another day in the desert or the wilderness of self-deception, the wilderness of self-righteousness, or the wilderness of illusion. Because when we boil all this down, at the end of the day, and even at the end of our life, when we take our last breath, the only thing that will truly matter is the gift that Christ has given us on the cross. Amen.